Hello everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I think our common challenge, which we very much agree on, is the need to demonstrate together that democracies can deliver.
Antony Blinken in Berlin. The Secretary of State's deputy, Wendy Sherman, joins me about reviving the Iran deal she helped negotiate and the challenge of China. Plus,
my thing, I tell him like this, it's like Shakespeare with an
artist. Where hip-hop meets Shakespeare. I talk to the highly influential British rapper, author and activist, Akala. Then, love and loss. Clint Johnson from the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus talks to our Michelle Martin about the power of song and the lasting impact of the AIDS epidemic. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Pro-democracy voices in Hong Kong are gasping for air after the draconian crackdown on dissent claimed another victim today, and a very prominent one. The newspaper Apple Daily, the popular tabloid, announced that it'll print its last edition on Thursday. Last week, hundreds of Hong Kong police raided the office and arrested top executives under the new national security law imposed by China. Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam insists the paper is being punished for violating the law.
Don't try to accuse the Hong Kong authorities for using the national security law as a tool to suppress the media or to stifle the freedom of expression.
But this is a crackdown and a blow against freedom of speech. The US State Department has called for the release of the paper's jailed executives as America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, is overseas again to promote democracy in the face of rising authoritarianism. As number two at the State Department, Wendy Sherman is tasked with managing America's relationship with China. And she is no stranger to working with adversaries. She was a key figure in negotiating the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. And the Deputy Secretary of State is joining me now. Welcome to the program. Welcome back to our program. So you have a bit of a conundrum. You have your Secretary of State and your president, you know, talking a great game about promoting democracies right under our noses. It's being eradicated in Hong Kong, which was meant to be a bastion for at least 50 years after the handover. What actually can the United States do?
The United States can certainly speak out, as we are today, as Foreign Secretary Robb of Great Britain, who, in fact, Great Britain turned over Hong Kong to China under an agreement that ensured their autonomy and democracy and freedom of expression. And as the foreign secretary said today, this is a chilling blow to freedom. And Jimmy Lai, the founder of Apple Daily, who was arrested last year and faces perhaps life in prison, said, and I know you will agree with this, Christiane, that delivering information is delivering freedom. And indeed, the United States must continue to speak out that journalists be free, that in fact, Apple Daily was doing just that till its closure, that the national security law, which the executive spoke of, is indeed quashing dissent, quashing freedom of expression. It is not bringing public order. It is creating just the opposite. It is creating disorder in a community in Hong Kong, which is used to freedom of expression, freedom of movement, and a measure of democracy in a very difficult situation. We will see what other specific actions we can take, but speaking out is critical. And as you know, and as you yourself have done, ensuring freedom of journalists around the world and having human rights at the center of our foreign policy, as President Biden and Secretary Blinken have said, is absolutely critical.
And indeed, we speak out about it because journalists are often the bellwether for freedom, reform and democracy. And we are the prime targets, whether it's in Hong Kong, as we've just been talking about, whether it's in Belarus and the actual forcing down by a military aircraft of a civilian aircraft to try to get a journalist off the plane. And the space for dissidents Pro-democracy dissidents all over the world is shrinking as authoritarianism rises. So again, beyond speaking out, what can the U.S. do? Because clearly, given what President Biden has articulated it is as his main mission to promote democracy, what actually can you do? Or are you in a bind and you can't really do anything?
Well, no, I don't think we're in a bind. I think what we saw when the president went to Europe just a few days ago, and the secretary is now back there now, is to build our alliances so that we act together in concert with our allies and partners, whether that is in speaking out, applying sanctions, taking direct action where necessary, providing refuge for those who feel that they are at risk. All of these are important actions. And indeed, when the United States and Europe acted together against the genocide against the Uyghurs in China, this made a great impression and had an effect on the PRC. So I think our acting in concert with our European allies is absolutely crucial. We've made great progress in a few short months of the Biden-Harris administration to do just that. And Secretary Blinken is back in Europe, intensifying those relationships on a variety of issues, from Libya to de-ISIS, to the G20, to our bilateral relationships, to make sure that we can speak out, that we can act, that we can sanction, that we can provide refuge, that we can work with our partners to show that democracy delivers for people. And that is very key also to the foreign policy of the Biden-Harris administration. And that is to make sure that our national security policy helps the middle class here in America.
Okay. You said that the tough response against the genocide against the Uyghurs in China, they sat up and took notice. I wonder how. First of all, I want to play you a bit of an interview that I did exclusively a few months ago with the Chinese ambassador to the United States, who's just announced his retirement back to Beijing. But, you know, they spoke very clearly about how they continue and they will continue their policy against the Uyghurs. This is what he said.
What we did was not to start a war there. We did not use missiles or drones. We set up efforts for education and training, help people to learn more about the law, to acquire good skills, to improve their lives, find good jobs. And all this has made a huge difference. There has been no single terrorist attack in the last few years. And in terms of the population, the Uyghur population has more than doubled in the last four decades. So how can people talk about so-called genocide?
Wendy Sherman, the ambassador, i.e. Beijing, seems to be sticking to its guns. But I want to know how you think your stance made a difference. What do you see as a result of your tough words about the genocide against the Uyghurs?
I think it's not just tough words. It was the sanctions where, in fact, there was accountability and a price to be paid. Look, our relationship with China is a very complex one, Christiana, as you've heard Secretary Blinken and President Biden speak. We will challenge China where we must. We will compete with China because this is the world in which we all live. And we will cooperate with China where we can. But human rights is one area where we will continue to challenge. We will continue to speak out. We will continue to work for accountability, just as we must challenge them in what they're trying to do to stop freedom of navigation in the South China Sea or to steal American trade secrets through hacking our companies. At the same time, when it comes to climate change, we need to cooperate because we will not be able to ensure the future of this planet without China taking concerted action. We will work with China when it comes to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, which you mentioned in the setup for this program. But we will compete, and the infrastructure plan that President Biden is working so decidedly on, the American Action Plan, Family Plan, all of these things are meant to say that we are going to claim the 21st century, and we're going to make sure that America and our allies and partners together are ready to embrace this century and all the technology and change that comes with it.
So clearly the human rights community and individuals who are the sharp end of a violation of human rights are going to take comfort and be pleased to hear those words, because so many administrations promise it and then other things take over, realpolitik or whatever you call it. So to that end, I want to ask you to respond to Senator Bernie Sanders, who is appealing to the administration not to start another Cold War, you know, saying it was you know, headed that way under the Trump administration, but not to pursue that. Let me just read what he just wrote in Foreign Affairs. Bernie Sanders says the primary conflict between democracy and authoritarianism is taking place not between countries but within them, including in the United States. And if democracy is going to win out, it will do so not on a traditional battlefield, but by demonstrating that democracy can actually deliver a better quality of life for people than authoritarianism can. Now, you touched on that and you said that the administration wants to make sure that that proof is in the pudding. Again, you're in charge of managing this relationship. China seems, as I said to one official, kind of unembarrassable, unshameable on the things that it considers in its vital interest. It has said terrible things. President Xi Jinping has said publicly, show them no mercy when talking about the Uyghurs. He has completely hardened the Chinese policy towards human rights and any kind of dissent, unlike anything since Mao. What is the trick that you may have learned from Iran or other adversaries that you think you can apply to trying to get them to play ball a bit more on the things that are important to you and to the world?
Christian, I don't think there is a trick or a gimmick. I don't think this is something that changes overnight.
I don't mean a trick or a gimmick. I mean a thing, a real bit of educated experience that you've had in your negotiations with other very recalcitrant regimes.
It takes persistence. It takes courage to speak out and to not be afraid to do so, and to take action to hold countries and even our own country accountable for what we do when we go astray as well. One of the major differences between the United States and China is we understand we have flaws. We have a legal system. We have a framework to address those flaws, to try to improve and make more perfect our union. China does not take that approach. China stifles dissent, stifles its flaws, looks in the other direction, tries to justify what it does. And it is quite critical that the international community speak with one voice about ensuring that that is held accountable, that kind of action, that we will not turn away from it. We will have to work with China where we can, compete with China where we must, challenge China where we must, and speak out about human rights at the same time. All of these things must be done simultaneously in a consistent, persistent way to not only take note, but to hold countries, including ourselves, accountable when, in fact, there are concerns of human rights. You know, one of the things that China does is it speaks of sovereignty all the time, but never speaks about individual rights and human rights. Sovereignty is important, but so is the individual, and so is our people's ability to have life and liberty and to pursue prosperity and happiness.
I'm just going to note here, because in all fairness, I need to say that many of the dissidents and the pro-democracy activists in that region actually quite appreciated President Trump's belligerence against China. Now, it may or may not have delivered, and of course, people will have different views, but they appreciated that he put them on the back foot. Now, I want to ask you another really important issue, which is Afghanistan. And conversely, President Trump appeared to have entered a deal with the Taliban that was not conditions-based and that the Taliban did not meet the good faith that the United States under the Trump administration put into an attempted peace negotiation. Right now, the Wall Street Journal has published an exclusive report quoting American intelligence that fears that within six months of your administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan, a non-conditions-based withdrawal, the democratically elected government could fall. I want to know your reaction to that, particularly since the president of Afghanistan is coming to meet your president, Biden, this week at the White House.
First of all, let's be clear. We are withdrawing our troops from Afghanistan, but we are not withdrawing from Afghanistan. We will have a very robust diplomatic and humanitarian assistance presence in Afghanistan. We will continue to support the Afghanistan military in its efforts to ensure the security of its own country. The United States initially went in there to make sure that we followed up on 9/11 and did not have terrorists continue to attack the United States of America. So we believe that we have achieved the core of that mission. We will be able to deal with any such risk that or threat that comes again. But we are not withdrawing from Afghanistan. We are just withdrawing our troop presence and changing our posture. When President Ghani and Dr. Abdullah come to Washington this week, we will reassure them of our presence, of our continued support, and our continued support for a peace negotiation to ensure that there's really sustainability for Afghanistan. We will also encourage them to unify their country and to build the future that is necessary for the Afghan people.
You're a really experienced diplomatic hand. You've been around the table and in the room for so many decades. You can see with your own eyes that the Taliban are gobbling up territory in advance of the U.S. withdrawal, that your own chairman of the Joint Chiefs have said that their incredible success on the battlefield right now, under your eyes, as you withdraw, has taken this government by surprise. Afghan officials say that the Taliban are circling major cities, controlling major roads. They're going to put pressure on Kabul, and that they are heading towards a takeover. And they're very, very worried. I know what you said, that you're going to try to stop them, but how? I just want to know, are you concerned about the military gains they're making on, you know, in situ?
Of course, we're always concerned about gains that the Taliban make. Most of them right now are in territory that is really Taliban-controlled more than it is by the Afghan National Forces. We will continue to provide support to the Afghan National Forces. We have been training, equipping, and helping them for many years. They are very capable. We believe they will be able to hold the territory that they must to have the leverage for the peace negotiations, which are ongoing and are not yet resolved. Look, Christiane, I share all of the concerns that you are expressing, including the concerns for women and girls in Afghanistan. You may well recall from our own discussions in the past, former Secretary Albright and I were at the Peshawar refugee camp in Pakistan when women and girls were thrown out of Afghanistan or left quickly because the Taliban were taking away every right they ever had. And I listened to horrifying stories about what happened to women and girls under Taliban rule. None of us wants that to happen again. We are all committed to ensuring that does not happen again. It has been very key to the negotiations that have been ongoing. And we will continue to do the hard work of diplomacy to ensure and support the Afghans themselves in reaching peace and a governance structure that ensures the rights of all Afghans, including women and girls.
I just want to ask you a final question because I set it up and we mentioned it about the Iran nuclear deal. Clearly, it seems both the United States and your partners and Iran wants to get back into this deal for your own, you know, reasons to have this arms control deal. And they want the lifting of sanctions. But there seem to be red lines. And, you know, the United States would like a deal plus, as Tony Blinken says, Secretary of State says, longer and stronger. The Iranians would like to have a deal that ensures no U.S. president can unilaterally pull out, as President Trump did. Are they bridgeable? And despite the fact that you both want to get back in, do you believe that it will happen? Could we be left without a deal after all of this?
I certainly believe it's possible. We have a terrific negotiating team that has been working on this, along with the Europeans and Russia and China. So, yes, I think it is possible. But there are also political decisions to be made here. You know that Iran has just elected a new president. He will be inaugurated in August. He is very different than the current president. Some believe that he wants this deal to get done now so that he has the relief from sanctions relief that will help the economy of Iran. Others believe that he's not so excited about this. And ultimately, It will be the supreme leader of Iran who will make a decision about whether, in fact, the deal is done, just as the president of the United States must. For us, it has to be compliance for compliance. Iran knows what it must do, ensuring that it can never obtain a nuclear weapon. They haven't made all those final decisions yet. Everyone can see the outlines of a deal, but until you get to the very last detail in negotiating with Iran on this compliance for compliance, we will not know if we have gotten there. You can get 99% of the way there, and then they will have to decide whether they really want to do this and click in that last piece of the puzzle to make it real. So yes, it's possible, but we don't know the end of the story yet. Iran knows what it must do, and we'll see if they'll do it.
Still on a knife edge then. Thank you so much, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, for being with us tonight. And now, what do hip-hop and Shakespeare have in common? A lot more than you might think, says my next guest.
It's like Shakespeare with a little twist. It's William back from the dead, but I rap out gas and I'm black instead. It's Shakespeare reincarnated, except I spit flows and strip pros naked.
So that's the award-winning British rapper, activist and author Akala, a social commentator for our time. His memoir, Natives, shot up the bestseller list during last summer's racial reckoning, and it's now being developed into a docu-series for the BBC. His debut novel, The Dark Lady, is out now. Akala, welcome to our program. Great to have you on. So let me just start by asking you, what do Shakespeare and rap and hip hop have in common? And you've invested a lot in this thought and in this process.
Yeah, we founded a company about 10 years ago called the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company, which was a music theatre production and education company that does workshops, live events, residencies, theatre productions, etc. And really, one of the things I wanted to explore was not just the obvious linguistic parallels and use of poetry and storytelling and so on, but more solidly the way in which I was always fascinated with that the Elizabethan era in London has really been heavily sanitized. Shakespeare was pretty much the only playwright who never went to prison. Of Shakespeare's closest contemporaries, one was stabbed through the eye and killed in a bar brawl. The other killed two people himself and pledged the benefit of the clergy. That's Ben Jonson and Christopher Marlowe. It was a very gritty time in London. Actually, the Elizabethan theatre was the only place where the rich and the poor conglomerated in the same place. It was the popular entertainment of its day. It was heavily involved with the underworld, so on and so forth. So there were lots of ways in which really we've sanitized that era and sanitized the role that theatre played in Elizabethan London. And as someone who was lucky enough to take my high school exit exam the year the Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet came out, I was all and grew up in a theatre, I was always interested in presentation on the stage and who had the right to be the custodian of that knowledge and the way in which particular artistic representations are portrayed and the way in which we interpret even modern day hip hop. You think of some of the greatest rappers of all time, a Biggie, a Kendrick Lamar, these people are first rate world class lyricists and storytellers. And perhaps some of people's aversion to or reaction against that recognition is more about the backgrounds of the people involved and the class origins of the people involved than it is about an objective analysis of the quality of the work. You think of an album like Stillmatic by Nas or so on and so forth, to say nothing of hip hop's global influence as a cultural force.
Okay, so I'm really interested by, you know, how you describe the audience at the time. And we know, because that's what history tells us, that some 90% of the audience for Shakespeare at the time couldn't read or write. But they just went and you know, absorbed it and presumably loved it. Now, though, it's basically suggested that the 21st century and the 20th century audience are really, it's more like, you know, for the elites. And you've talked about the class structure. How do you think we can break that down, or does it still resonate with the people who Shakespeare was trying to reach, which were not the elites?
Probably not as much. I mean, obviously he had his relationship with the elite and had patronage of monarchs and so on and so forth, but the theatre was a unique institution at that time because it was probably the only place that rich and poor interacted. And what's really happened in a way, in my view, is a sort of post-Victorian cultural co-optation where the Elizabethan theatre even received pronunciation. So what most people think of as the Queen's English or proper English is an invention that comes 150, 200 years after Shakespeare died. So Shakespeare didn't speak proper English. He invented thousands of words, so on and so forth. But I think touching on both the books I've written, The Dark Lady and Natives, really are rooted in the idea of class in Britain and the way in which Britain is still to this day a class-obsessed society. And it has roots in this era and in the Industrial Revolution and in hereditary aristocracy and so on and so forth. And I think the way in which the theatre has become this sort of sanitised, quiet place is representative of that. In its actual time, the theatre was more like a cross between a sort of modern rock concert and a rap show. And actually people would say stuff like, I'm going to hear a play, which is where the word audience comes from, because they were very conscious about the fact that it was very much about the wordplay and not about acting in a modern sense.
So in that case, I'm going to read some of your words that, you know, about Shakespeare. You rapped it, but the clip we have is not very audible, so I'm going to read it. You say, I'm similar to William, but a little different. I do it for kids that's illiterate, not Elizabeth. Stuck on the road, faces screwed up, feel like that world spat them out and they chewed up.
Yeah, I mean, that was a song that's for a long time ago and probably doesn't scan as well as it listens to one song. But really, it was about exactly that, you know, looking at the way in which I think the British education system reproduces a lot of the inequalities of British class society. And I was someone who was very lucky, who was part of a sort of Pan-African Saturday school movement. So when post-war Caribbeans came to Britain, they weren't satisfied with the kind of education that existed in Britain schools and the racism that a lot of British Caribbean children were receiving. So they set up special Pan-African Saturday schools. I went to one of those. My stepdad was also the stage manager of what was probably London's leading black-led cultural institution in the 1980s, a place called the Hackney Empire Theatre, theatre with an F, because, you know, we don't pronounce our T's properly around here. But ultimately, you know, I was very lucky in that sense. And so I felt a sense of cultural entitlement to the stage and to the page that came from this Pan-African Saturday school movement. They helped me avoid lots of the pitfalls that lots of young people born into similar families to mine go through. And I suppose that's sort of what that's about. Like what I received very early, being lucky enough to have cultural enrichment coming from my community, being lucky enough to have Saturday school, access to the arts, despite being economically poor and having a lot of those other cliches, is something I've always tried to put into my work, both the books and the music.
I just want to quickly ask you, because I think it's incredible, given you've explained part of your background, and we'll get a little bit more into it, but that you were raised by a single mother, your parents split, they were not married before you were born, but she kept giving you books as gifts, as presents on special occasions. And that really, you know, brought you to where you are today.
Well, I wouldn't say it was quite that simple. You know, the argument I'm making in the whole book Natives is basically looking at the British class system and the British Empire. Obviously, my dad's family's from Jamaica, my mum's family's from Scotland, my mother's family were in the British Army. In fact, she was born in Germany and brought up in Hong Kong because her dad was in the army. So even in my own family, there's this history and relationship to empire. And what I point out is that in many ways, a lot of the stereotypes that existed in Britain of my community just weren't very accurate. And that's what saved me, because I had Black Saturday school, because I had this cultural offering, because I had not just my mum, but actually even some of my uncles, not all of whom were perfectly well behaved, threatening to beat me up if I dropped out of school. There was actually a lot of the stereotypes of poorer communities, poorer Black communities in particular, are not accurate. And so my argument is more than my own individual willingness to read or just, you know, being interested in literature, this broad-based community support was a huge part of why I was able to, quote unquote, pull myself out of poverty. And so I've spent lots of my adult life trying to do that work, doing works in schools, in prison, and working with young people, because I was so fortunate to receive that community support myself.
So I think this is really crucial, because obviously it begins with education and the opportunity, no matter what class or demographic or ethnicity you come from. That's the crucial first step, many, many say. And there's so much controversy about it, not just here in the UK, but also in the US. And I want to know whether you draw any parallels or differences. A recent report commissioned by the Prime Minister's office here, number 10 Downing Street, basically declares there is no such thing as systemic racism in this country. And, you know, the British believe that they don't have the same problem at all that the United States does, where it's generally accepted that there is institutional racism. Tell me how you see what the government has now said and the differences with the United States.
I wrote a whole chapter on exactly this in Natives called Britain and America, and it literally contrasts with primary source material the difference between public government rhetoric and what they do privately. So, for example, After World War II, all of the British Caribbean, and in fact, the entire British Commonwealth, were legally citizens of Britain, with the right, which included the right to live and work in Britain. Once Caribbeans started actually coming to Britain, and people from the Indian subcontinent started coming to Britain, what the government did was start to threaten the governments of those countries that they wouldn't issue passports and all this sort of stuff. And privately, they were very clear that the issue was about skin color. So if we think about the Caribbean, very culturally English, obviously Jamaica had been a democracy before the United States or before Canada, for example. So the British government was very clear that people from the Caribbean were culturally English at the time. English speakers, Christian. Jamaica had been ruled, which is where my dad's from, since the middle of the 17th century. Yet the British government then changed the entire legislation of citizenship based on skin color. Bear in mind, they were subsidizing the migration of millions of people from post-war Europe and Ireland to come to Britain at the exact same time, and subsidizing the migration of people from Britain to the Commonwealth at the exact same time. But black and brown Commonwealth citizens coming to Britain were excluded from citizenship solely based on the grounds of race. I'll give you one quote that gives you a sense of the difference between what the government says publicly and what the government says privately. The Home Secretary at the time, Rab Butler, said of the Commonwealth Immigration Act, "Its great benefit is that it can be presented as non-discriminatory, while its restrictive intent is indeed intended to and will apply to colored people almost exclusively." So the need to deny public intention of racism is as old as racism itself. That said, there are significant differences between Britain and the United States, because obviously African and Caribbean and Asian migrants migrated to a country, Britain, with a large white underclass already established, where with an inherent class system that wasn't just based on skin color. Whereas, of course, in the United States, the British Empire exported the British class system and placed a race-based veneer on what they had originally perfected in, say, the colonization of Ireland. So, yes, there are significant differences. No one is suggesting that police brutality is as bad in Britain as in America. Gun violence in general is not as bad in Britain as in America. But this sort of patting ourselves on the back as if, but then at the upper end, right, there's not been the equivalence of a Quincy Jones or all of the successes that have happened in the United States that we could point to. Black American successes, massive impact on culture, massive contributions to science and technology, people like Shonda Rhimes and so on and so forth. So the simple sort of, oh, America is where racism happens, Britain isn't, is a very juvenile way of understanding the ways in which state power, capital, and ordinary people interact.
I just want to get to your novel, as we said, Our Dark Lady, The Dark Lady. It's your first novel. It's aimed at young adults. And its protagonist is Henry. He's black. And it's set in Elizabethan England in the working class. Why did you choose this? I mean, clearly it's, you know, connected with your, you know, your experience with Shakespeare, obviously. But why did you choose this now?
Because I think there's a whole host of myths about British history. And one of them is obviously that the black presence in Britain began with the Windrush in 1948, internalized myths. One of the things that's fascinating about this period, there were only a small number of Africans in Elizabethan London, probably a few hundred, maybe a few thousand at most. But depending which scholars you consult, but there were enough that a merchant working on behalf of Queen Elizabeth attempted to form a petition to have the Moors, as they were called at the time, of which there are already too many in this realm, this is his quote, expelled from Elizabethan London. He wasn't successful. One of the things that's fascinating about this period is that a lot of the prejudice against people was also against workers from what today is Belgium and the Low Countries, that region of Europe. So there was an anti-immigrant sentiment already. There was a lot of poverty already. And there was early forms of anti-black bigotry that had not yet taken on the form that they would take after Britain's major entrance into the transatlantic slave trade. But one of the reasons I was always fascinated about this period is precisely because of that. It is in this period before Britain is this big global empire. It is a period of time where Britain is very conscious that Ottoman Turkey is more powerful. I mean, Elizabethan government had an allegiance with Morocco against Catholic Spain. Can you imagine that today, England having an allegiance with a Muslim power against a power within the EU? So it's a very, very different time politically. And I wanted to highlight some of that. But I wanted to also highlight that there were so many parallels between life for the underclass in London then, albeit much more extreme, and life for the underclass in London today. In many ways, this sort of Dickensian massive inequality, cheek by jowl, right next to each other. London has always been like that and continues to be like that today. So I feel like it was a story that had massive modern resonances.
Akala, great perspective. Really great to hear from you. And thank you so much for joining us. Now, to the power of a different kind of music and art amid love and terrible loss. The first case of AIDS was reported 40 years ago this month. Millions of people all over the world have lost their lives to the virus. The San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus feels the pain of that tragedy acutely. It has lost over 300 singers to AIDS since the choir was founded back in 1978. Clint Johnson has been a member of the chorus for over 34 years, and here he is with Michelle Martin reflecting on the impact of the AIDS crisis and the legacy of the chorus.
Thanks, Christiane. Clint Johnson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
You know, we are acknowledging the 40th anniversary of the first reported cases of HIV/AIDS. Since then, it's claimed 32 million lives worldwide. But I was wondering if you wouldn't remind if you wouldn't mind taking us back to those early days when we really didn't know what was happening. Do you remember when you first heard about HIV/AIDS and what you heard and what that was like?
Actually, yes, I do. I was actually visiting my parents at the time, and you know, the first reports started coming in, and it was confusing and it was unclear about what exactly was going on. Being part of a marginalized community in that way and working in the activism that, you know, the chorus does, you know, you're well aware of how your community is seen, and with the mixed reports and the confusion, if you will, around how serious people were taking this. When it seemed to be more serious here in the community, was a little distressing.
I remember it well, that there was a lot of stigma. There was a lot of, you know, there were shunning of people, people being afraid to have people in their homes. There was this question of, you know, what can I do? Like, can you hug people? But you know, I just, sometimes when you're going through something like that, you internalize it. What was that like for the chorus? Did it strain relations within the group?
I never experienced that. And I didn't see much of that, although I can't imagine that, you know, it was completely devoid of any of that. So much of that is fear-based. And what was happening was frightening. The thing that impressed me more than anything else and made an impression upon me was how people in the chorus did not turn away. That, you know, we embraced, you know, what we needed to do. We thought about ways to make the lives of our friends and chorus members better. How can I step in to help? There was far less concern. I mean, there was obviously awareness of, you know, needing to be mindful of your own safety and health. But at the same time, the need was so great and so apparent. You know, when you're faced with that option, fortunately, most people, you know, decide, okay, the risk that I have to sustain or I have to bear is not as threatening, or the implications of having to deal with it are not as grave as the person who is standing before me who now has to face death. Because at that time it was a death sentence. And how do you walk away from somebody who you know is standing there, somebody you know, somebody you work with, somebody you care about, you know, in various ways, who is going to, based on how things were going, quite possibly die a slow, painful, lonely, and terrifying death? You know, how can you turn your back and say, you know, my fear is more important than helping you through this?
How did people help each other through it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
How did they?
We established care teams. And, you know, we divvy up whatever kinds of responsibilities needed to be covered, you know, to care for the person, be it housekeeping, grocery shopping, getting people to doctor's appointments, making sure that visitors were there, you know. But all of the things that need to happen, like when you, if you're caring for a family member who's ill, all of those things happened. As an organization, we began to focus on how to tell these stories, how to affirm our lives and the lives of the people that we were singing about, how to bring joy when we can, how to help people not forget that there is so much more to our existence and our lives than this moment of discomfort and pain.
I can't think of any other way to ask this, but the chorus lost, as I understand it, some 300 members to HIV/AIDS over the course of its life. And, you know, you've had like 2,000 members overall. That's a huge number of people.
It is.
I mean, losing 300 people is a huge number of people.
It is. It is. I think the thing that is most powerful is not just the individuals, but because it's hard to separate myself from the whole group experience because it happened to all of us at the same time. And no matter what part of the process you were involved in, be it, you know, caring for somebody, grieving for somebody, just coming out of grieving for somebody, helping somebody care for somebody, or caring for somebody who just finished caring for somebody. There were all kinds of people around you constantly who were in that same place, no matter what it was. So it was never really a singular experience. And the losses, you know, it hurt me to see my friends lose their friends as much as it hurt me to lose mine. But it is... the thing that hurts the most is, so you're going to make me cry. The thing that hurts the most is losing people that brought such light to your life and to the world. And knowing that no matter how much you did, you couldn't save them. Knowing how much was lost by the other people in their lives, the joy that they brought, you know, how they made you feel, the work that they did, you know, the talents that they shared. You know, it's hard to fathom that amount of loss in that length of time because it didn't stop. There were people who sang, you know, came to rehearsals and prepared to sing as many concerts as they could. And you know, you wonder if this person is going to make it to the show. And it's tough to go through that.
Did you ever feel like it was just too much? Like you wanted to get in your car and drive away and just not come back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's where some of, you know, some guilt comes in because there were times when I couldn't do another memorial. Mm-hmm. You know, I just didn't have it in me. And as much as I wanted to honor the person who had passed, I just couldn't do it. I have not, and I know so many, you know, survivors who have not been able to process the amount of loss. I mean, how do you, like for some, I know people who've lost hundreds of friends in, you know, a year. How do you process that amount of loss when you came together in many respects as a family because the world was not having you. You know, the world was not going to support. So you bonded together over the things that you shared in common. And all of these people are gone. They're gone. And so much of the world didn't seem to care.
There's this famous picture that the artistic director came up with this idea to represent the toll.
Yes.
Ed Luce of the Chronicle took a portrait of the chorus showing seven of their members in a white dress shirt with the rest dressed in black, facing away from the audience. And the seven in white represented, to tell me again, just what represented what? The seven were the survivors and all the rest were those who had died?
Yes.
So you had basically these kind of dots of white in a sea of black.
Yeah.
That must have been... I don't know, just even being there kind of gives me chills.
Yeah. It was an interesting thing. It was an interesting experience to have. I was thinking about this the other day because we did another piece not too long ago called Unbreakable. And one of the movements in it was called 41. And it was about the first 41 people who were, you know, notified, who the world found out had passed away. And as we're singing this movement, we are turning our backs in bunches to represent, you know, as we're counting the numbers, people are turning around, so that by the end of the movement, everybody's back is turned. And it gave the audience an idea of what it felt like to, you know, be just this counting where you're just counting the bodies and you're just watching, you know, the backs turn as this person's face disappears, that person's face disappears. So it was a powerful, powerful statement and powerful experience.
How did you balance the need to challenge and the need to say hard things with also the need to bring joy and comfort to people?
Well, our artistic directors have been very, very good about being able to combine a mix of things. So we have, you know, you have your moment that, you know, with tears, you know, where we're gonna make you cry. Moments that are going to give you the chills and moments that are going to make you laugh, because these are all of the things that make up the life experience. And the one thing we don't want to do is do what is done to us and narrow us down to this very slice of what our life experience actually is. I think of during, you know, the epidemic, I think of the pain and I think of the loss, but I also think of the beauty that I saw in the courage and the strength of the people around me. And, you know, we are mindful that we are full people, we are complete, we are varied in our views and experiences, and we don't want to be reductive.
Do you have a favorite piece that represents that for you?
One song that we do that speaks to me is, it's called Never Ever. And it's on a piece that we did in 96, I believe, called Naked Man, which is a suite of songs about the gay experience. It is based on stories and interviews from men in the chorus. So it's telling actual stories. And Never Ever is the one that speaks to, I think, one of the things that we learned and that everybody hopefully learns, and unfortunately is often learned at great expense and loss, that the moment you have before you is really the only moment that you have. And, you know, you should treat each moment as a gift.
Give me a couple bars.
Never will there be a moment ever when we all will be together. Never.
Such a moment never will be looked around and see these faces.
More about the music that the chorus performs, and how is the experience of AIDS it reflected in the repertoire?
I think it is both reflected in the actual music that we pick in terms of the stories that we tell, some of the stories we tell. We often speak of it, you know, our director speaks about it during the performance, or there are the ways to bring, you know, what we call our fifth section, which is, you know, the members who have passed away. And we do performances at times where we have a stool with a rose and they show the list of names. So we do things like that. And I think that our sensitivities, you know, our emotional sensitivities are, and awareness is different. So we are more conscious of telling meaningful stories about ourselves, you know, making sure that we speak the truth of who we are, regardless of how painful it is to tell or hear.
Now, we as a country, as a world, you know, this last year and a half, we've been living through another epidemic. And I just have to wonder what that brought up for you.
A lot. A lot. I thought about that early on. You know, I was actually texting some friends and mentioned how, you know, for better or worse, we've been here before. We know what social lockdown and emotional lockdown looks and feels like. We know what it's like to have those in charge seemingly uninterested in our welfare. So it was re-traumatizing in a way. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. And the AIDS epidemic kind of, you know, put that in high relief. And the pandemic in many ways put that in high, you know, the uncertainty that people felt around everything and how one thing can cascade into other things. And people are going to be afraid of you and not want to help you and run from you. That was all very, very familiar. It's just that with this pandemic, it happened to everybody. Whereas with AIDS, it was concentrated in my community. And that was, I think, the starkest difference, that it was not a public concern. It was a political concern. Mm-hmm. And the cause for further vilification, as opposed to attempts to understand and figure out how we can get out of this.
Before we let you go, I was wondering, how would you want us to think of this period, the period of the greatest loss?
What I would like to see is people to not just remember the horror of it all, but remember the depth of humanity that my community showed, the grace that, you know, my community and my friends showed, the strength, the resilience, all of the things that, you know, remember us for the things that allowed us to survive this. Because I saw the best that humanity has to offer in the people that surrounded me. And we are not always seen as that community. You know, we're often seen as frivolous and, you know, all kinds of, you know, as I was alluding to earlier, the reductive ways in which we're viewed, when the depth of the humanity was astounding, the generosity, the compassion, the empathy, all of those things that allowed us to not only take care of each other, but take care of ourselves and our community. Who you are is shown when your back is up against the wall. Push came to shove, and this is what we did. So remember us for that.
Clint Johnson, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And so important to remember what happened then, and also to know that AIDS is still ravaging so much of the world. And finally, rare insights into pop culture's big mystery. Today, Britney Spears appears virtually before an LA court. She's speaking out formally for the first time in just over 2 years to again challenge her father, who's taken over her entire life, controlling her every move. It's called a conservatorship, and it's usually applied to the elderly or the mentally infirm. And yet, a vigorous, high-performing, high-earning 39-year-old pop star has had to hand over authority for years now, from her financial assets to who she dates, even to how she decorates her own home. I spoke with the director of the documentary Framing Britney Spears, Samantha Stark, about all of this when the film debuted in February.
The central mystery of our film really is, how could somebody make millions of dollars performing in Vegas, headlining her own show, you know, appearing on The X Factor and making albums, and also qualify for this layer of protection, which is usually meant for people who are incapable of making decisions in their own best interest. So it's very mysterious, and we don't know what the legal reasoning is behind it because all the records are sealed.
Could you figure out the dynamic between the father and Britney? And also, where's the mother on the scene right now? Lynn Spears.
Right. So it is, it's very confusing to us because what we do know about Jamie is that when Britney was growing up, he struggled with alcoholism. We know he went to rehab. We know he had trouble managing money and filed for bankruptcy, he and Lynn together. And it really, you really don't see that much of him in Britney's life until this conservatorship happened.
Now, with the Free Britney movement making a strong comeback, her fans demand not just answers, but a young woman's right to liberty. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching. Bianca Golodrigo will take you through the rest of this week. Bye from London for now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.